From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Donald Trump says he'll make a major speech on immigration in Arizona later this week after his staff and advocates have spent a weekend trying to explain what his policy is. Trump angered some of his supporters last week when he said in a Fox News town hall that he'd consider a path to legalization for immigrants in this country illegally, something he had previously said he was against. Here's Republican Party Chairman Reince Priebus on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
You're not going to have a pathway to citizenship with Donald Trump. That's off the table. Mm-hmm. There is no method by which someone is here illegally that is going to become a citizen and jump the line as Hillary Clinton wants to do.
Joining us now is NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, do we have any idea what Trump is going to say on Wednesday about his stance on people in this country illegally and immigration more broadly?
Hi, Jeremy. And no, we have no idea. And I would say that that's kind of part of the problem because, you know, we had been told on again that this event was on again, then it was off again. And, you know, his campaign and staff want to say nothing has changed in his policy. That's just simply not true. Plenty has happened. He tried to soften his tone when talking about the 11 million in the country illegally. He, of course, built his campaign around talking about building a wall. He, in November of last year, talked about a deportation force. He had said that people had to go even if they were born in the U.S. but were children of illegal immigrants. He made fun of Jeb Bush for saying that this was an act of love for why people come here. So I'm looking to see, what is he going to talk about with some specificity? Is he going to talk about birthright citizenship? Is he going to talk about what he will do with those 11 million? No more thorny of an issue has come up over the last decade than immigration, and Donald Trump is trying to walk a real fine line here.
And we will watch to see what he says. There's another thing he's been trying to do, which is to reach out to African-American voters, who he's doing very poorly with in all of the polls. And, you know, after we saw the cousin of Dwayne Wade, the Chicago Bulls player, shot and killed in Chicago, Trump tweeted, "Just what I've been saying, African-Americans will vote Trump." And then he's out there saying to them, "What do you have to lose? Vote for me." Is this an effective way to go after African-Americans? Is he actually trying to win over African-Americans with these words, or is this about convincing suburban white voters to vote for him?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that he is trying, and I think that it's probably a poor strategy when it comes to trying to win over African-Americans. He's trying to say, and I think we've been saying all along in this campaign, Donald Trump is trying to say X, but he's not very clear about what he's trying to say. What he is trying to say is that Rahm Emanuel is the mayor of Chicago. He's a Democrat, and Trump has been saying Democrats don't run cities very well, and places where there are inner city African-Americans who have voted Democrat for a long time should actually give Trump a chance. Well, he doesn't say it that well, but that's what he's trying to say. The reaction to this was sharp, seen as crass and generalizing. But I do think that where his big problem is with white voters, it's amazing. He's supposed to be appealing to white men in particular. White women he's been underperforming Mitt Romney with white women and white men pretty substantially from 2012. Hmm. And Donald Trump needs to turn that around pretty quickly because they were 72% of the electorate in 2012. And, you know, African-Americans, Hispanics, he's doing terribly with them. So he needs to bring up all of those numbers if he wants to win.
We've got news today, Domenico, that Huma Abedin, a top aide to Hillary Clinton, is separating from former Congressman Anthony Weiner after the New York Post reported that Weiner was involved in yet another sexting scandal. And I will leave people to go on Google and they can read all about that. But what about the political implications of this? Because we already have a statement from Donald Trump titled "Donald Trump's Statement on Hillary Clinton's Bad Judgment," trying to tie Weiner to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I think that's a stretch. But Hillary Clinton's aide, Huma Abedin, who's been close to her for some time, has had continuous problems with her former congressman husband, Anthony Weiner. We saw a New York Post cover story come out about how he's again gotten into some trouble with texting inappropriate photos of himself. And she put out a statement saying that after long and painful consideration, work on my marriage, I made the decision to separate from my husband. Now, they have a child together, and they're going to be working on that. And we can only hope he gets the help that he needs.
That's Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead political editor. Domenico, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, meteorologists are watching two tropical depressions today, one swirling off southern Florida and moving into the Gulf of Mexico, the other hovering off the coast of North Carolina. Now, both storms could soon become tropical, the last category before hurricane status. How bad is tropical? Ask Vermonters. It's been 5 years since Tropical Storm Irene dumped its record rainfall on Vermont. Estimates on bridge and road damage alone topped $700 million. Since then, the state's been trying to get people to plan for the next disaster. Howard Weiss Tisman from Here and Now contributor Vermont Public Radio reports.
Johnny Jump Ups? No, Jack in the Pulpit.
Jack in the Pulpit.
That had grown up. So then I put him into the flower bed.
Shirley Earle is standing near the Saxons River in Rockingham. Her house was here before Tropical Storm Irene washed it away in 2011. And Earle came out with her daughter recently for a visit.
Evrita, do you see these new flowers?
Earle walks with a cane, but she gets around the grassy slope pretty well. She points to where her trailer was and where she had a garden.
Got to come out every once in a while and look, check things out, but it'll still always be home. It's been for so long. Been through a lot here.
This was home for about 30 years, and Earle says she planned to leave the trailer and land to her family. But there wasn't much left after Irene.
Too much of our land is gone. It was a lot bigger lot than this before the flood. It took a lot of our land.
The storm took her land, her house, and just about everything she owned. So when she heard about the buyout program offered by FEMA, Earle said she was ready to sell. The FEMA Hazard Mitigation Grant Program gives money to towns and cities so they can purchase properties that have been damaged in floods. Kevin Geiger led the FEMA buyout program in Vermont following Tropical Storm Irene.
So the general idea of the program is to avoid future disaster costs. It's much easier to pay your one time, to never put it back, and for nobody to ever put it back. So you're whole, and nobody's ever going to do this again. We're, you know, that headache is over.
When all of the buyouts are done, the state will have about 150 fewer headaches. But Geiger says that doesn't mean there won't be more property loss, or worse, during the next flood. That's because the FEMA program only pays for homes that have already been damaged in disasters. And if you want to take a drive, Geiger can show you the properties across Vermont that are still susceptible to future flooding.
There's that, what's that movie, The Sixth Sense, you know, where the little kid says, I see dead people. When I drive around, I see flooded houses. But to tell that to people, you know, yeah, literally, to go up and knock on their door and say, you know, you should really move now, they don't believe it. A lot of people wrongly view the fact that we've had Irene as meaning we're not going to have another Irene, like, oh, that's, you know, that'll never happen again. No, that'll happen again, and it'll happen way sooner than they think it's going to happen.
It'll happen because it's happened for decades. Last year, the Agency of Commerce and Community Development looked at how flooding has historically affected the Vermont economy. The state put out a more than 700-page report, and it identified five communities that can make investments now toward future flood preparedness. Barry was near the top of the list.
This is Gunners Brook, and it flows from the Stevens Branch all the way up into Barrytown. Much of the watershed is actually outside of the city, but it all gets here one way or another. And this is where the rubber hits the road.
That's Barry's city manager, Stephen McKenzie, and he's standing on the Harrington Avenue Bridge, which crosses an extremely narrow channel in the middle of a residential neighborhood of this central Vermont community. During major floods, debris gets trapped in the channel, and the state identified this bridge as one of its top priorities in preventing further economic disruption during a flood. McKenzie says the million-dollar project includes installing racks upstream that will catch the debris, allowing water to flow through Barry in a more controlled manner.
It's a start. I mean, this is something I think the Barry, like most municipalities, will probably be working on for 20, 25 years. But we have to start someplace. So we made the decision to be very proactive, and that's what we're doing.
So that's $1 million for one bridge in a state that saw damage to more than 300 local and state bridges during Irene. And if you want to get an idea of just how much work still needs to be done, You should go visit Ben Rose in his office at the Department of Emergency Management and Homeland Security in Waterbury. Rose coordinated the Irene Recovery Program, and now he oversees the ongoing mitigation work across the state.
We're much better prepared for the next Irene. The problem is that the next thing will not exactly be the next Irene. It'll be something else. And we'll find out how well prepared for it we are when it happens.
After Irene, the state adopted the unofficial motto, Vermont Strong. And the state and federal government spent hundreds of millions of dollars making our bridges and culverts more resistant to flooding. But the projected path of the next flood is as wild and unpredictable as a raging river. And no one knows exactly where the water will end up. For Here and Now, I'm Howard Weiss Chisman.
Common is one of the most influential voices in hip-hop, his crowning moment an Oscar for the song Glory, co-written with John Legend for the film Selma.
Justice is juxtapositioning us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up.
Common began life as Lonnie Rashid Lynn, telling stories from his native South Chicago. Here's The Corner from the album B.
Now I roll in the O's with windows that don't roll. Down the roads with cars get broken and stole. These are the stories told by Stony and Cottage Grove. The world is cold, the block is hot as a stove. On the
He's the son of former ABA player and youth counselor Lonnie Lynn and educator Dr. Mahalia Ann Hines, and he's now out supporting a scholarship program funded by Allstate for students at historically black colleges. Common himself attended Florida A&M, and as you'll hear, he's a big booster of the mentoring that black men can give each other. We spoke recently, and a note to listeners, our conversation includes a song lyric some might find offensive, but we began with, hello.
Peace, how are you?
I'm just fine. And I'm thinking, with that pedigree, your mom an educator, your dad a youth counselor, I'm not surprised you're backing kids. But what else is your thinking here with this scholarship program?
Well, my thinking is growing up, my friends that I grew up around, some of them didn't have what I had. I had a mother who was very loving and an educator who made sure I did well in school and worked hard so that I could go to school. Well, unfortunately, some of my friends didn't have a father or a mother that were there for several reasons. And I always looked at that and said, man, I want to help people who don't have. Because these are people that I saw that were good people that I cared about. And they just didn't have some of the, you know, just the natural blessings that human beings deserve.
Well, you know, I'm also thinking, you know a bit about how passions can become inflamed. I've been thinking about some of the feuds you had when you were younger with West Coast rappers. You know, when you were first starting out, they thought you were calling them out on the direction of hip hop. You and they sat down with Louis Farrakhan to resolve that. And then there was the back and forth with Drake, the Canadian singer rapper, about singing and rapping. I don't even care, you know, what it was about. But then on your album One Day, you put in this verse, you know the one, when I was a child, I talked like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. And I'm wondering if maybe you're seeing yourself as something of almost an elder statesman now, you know, maybe someone who's assuming more of a responsibility with young people.
Well, it's funny, you know, I read that Bible verse just today. That's Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And I feel like my experiences and my opportunities are the things that I want to bring to our youth and like say, hey, y'all, like I've been able to achieve some of these things and I'm still like striving to grow and do even greater things. But I want you all to know that you have the opportunity to achieve this and more. And though, you know, I feel like I'm still a child in certain manners, you know, like as far as just growing and learning more about art and music and life and culture, I still have some ways that are childish, though, you know, I take on the responsibility of a leader and a man in life. I still know there's room to grow.
Yeah. Well, you told Ebony Magazine your upcoming EP is called Little Chicago Boy, and you debuted a song called Home a few weeks ago on another radio show.
Well, look, Robin, I got to tell you, since that Ebony interview, things have grown. It's an album now, and it's called A Bigger Picture Called Free. That's the name of the album project, and it's a social political piece of art, and it's just so many things, topics, and issues that I'm talking about in this music, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, tell us what you want to say, because here's a little bit of the song Home.
Inside of darkness till they lights is on. I'ma put a hyphen on your name. Rapper, actor, activist. You the one that can reach into the black abyss. Stars this
So there's the lyrics. You the one that can reach into the black abyss. What do you mean by that?
Okay, let me say some of the lyrics to Home so they can. I say, heard the sound of the trumpets, a voice from the throne. Seen the 24 elders and I knew I was home. I was told to write a song for the people. Take the original Hebrews on an exodus, a black excellence. Tell them to invest in us and make testaments about each other on how we sisters and brothers. Cover the land and corners with poems of stone. Go hard with it. Let them know you God with it, even though I authored it. Let no one margin it and make it all about paper and first week sales. Though this is from heaven, give them verses from hell. Those that fell off the path, bring them back to the math. Your staff will be your microphone. Your name is Common. You was born to fight the norm. Take house niggas out of darkness till they lights is on. I'ma put a hyphen on your name. Rapper, actor, activist. You the one that can reach into the black abyss. Stars this asterisk, showing what a classic is. Freedom riders need passengers. In your lyrics, use scriptures and passages to make them rise like Lazarus and resurrected again. They'll put disrespect on your name and respect it again for every section you in. Bless them and keep bussing. If they don't like it, shake the dust and say uckum. Until you come home, I'm the one you trust in. So that's the first verse to Home. What I'm saying in that is it's like God telling me what my purpose is. And when I say I'm the one that can reach into the black abyss, I'm just saying God is telling me you're the one that can do some of these things, reach into the deepness of black culture and express it and inspire and touch. I'm not the only one, but it's just saying I'm one of the ones who can reach into the black abyss.
Well, and there's quite an abyss right now. Some would say you're from Chicago. I don't have to tell you about the murder rate there. We've been witnessing a consciousness about use of force against African-Americans. Every report coming out saying that it's disproportional. But we also have a targeting of police. And I want to ask you about that because there's the 2000 song for Asata that celebrates Asata Shakur, godmother of Tupac, but also the woman who was found guilty years ago for killing a state trooper in New Jersey. She eventually escaped prison, fled to Cuba. She's on the FBI's most wanted list. In this song, you are sympathetic to her. I'm going to bring you back after, but let's listen to a little.
She could tell by the light. Handcuffed tight to the bed, through her skin they bit. With guns to her head, every word she got hit. We shot the trooper, they asked her. Put the mace in her eyes, threatened to blast her. Her mind raced, still things got still. Opened her eyes, realized she's next to her best friend who got killed.
And Common, as you well know, you were invited to the Obama White House. Police were in an uproar. John Stewart even debated Bill O'Reilly about whether or not you were encouraging cop killing by supporting Asata Shakur, a convicted cop killer. So be clear now. Were you sympathetic to the shooting or to her claim of innocence?
I was sympathetic to her claim of innocence. I will never, like, condone or support the killing of any human beings. No police officers. No black people, no white people, no Asian. That's not what I'm about. I'm not about that. I'm about bringing love and life. And I wrote that song because when I read her autobiography, I believed that she was innocent. I believed her. And let's face it, it's people that we know in our judicial system that have been innocent, that have been accused of crimes that they didn't commit. And though she was a Black Panther, that didn't necessarily make her a murderer. You know?
Well, Common, you've said now that now with new music and your role now, you think it's your job, other people's jobs to reach into the black abyss to help the African-American community. How do you do that? And are there lyrics that you're hearing from others? We just heard Miguel, one of his lyrics, I'm tired of human lives turned into hashtags. How do you hope to do this thing that you feel is your job to do?
Well, I think art is definitely something that helps change the perspective and inspire people to movements. I think the movement right now is about black people being acknowledged, being respected and valued in this country. And with the music, I think it's really just to raise the consciousness of people and say, hey, we are people here, like, that are created from the same God that you created from, that love like you love and want to enjoy our children and, like, want to laugh and we cry, like, we're human beings. I know we've been depicted in media as other things, but don't forget it, we are human beings.
Does that mean also, Common, taking some of the gratuitous violence and misogyny out of hip-hop, maybe expressing everything you just said more in hip-hop, the joy and the beauty?
I think the joy and the beauty is very necessary in hip-hop also, but it would be, I would be like going against what art and music and even, you know, the First Amendment is for me to say that we shouldn't express ourselves. People shouldn't be able to speak and say what they would like. But I do believe in hip-hop culture, it would be great to have a balance, because hip-hop culture is balanced. It is, it's love and it's freedom and it's peace, but it's also some pain and it's some struggle and it's also fun and parties. You know, it's so many aspects. I think it's more about the balance than it is just taking out. You just don't want to remove people's voices and say, well, you shouldn't rap about these things, if that's their way of expressing it and getting it out. Because a lot of people are going through things that we may not be able to relate to, or, you know, some people in society can't relate to. But it's still important that their voices be heard.
That's Common, Chicago's rapper, actor, activist. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's been great to talk to you. And I'm going to come back to you with more music soon, too.
We're going to hold him to that. And we'll link you to the Historically Black College Scholarship Program that Common is now backing at hearnow.org.
Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
The manufacturer of the EpiPen said today that it'll introduce a cheaper generic version of its popular allergy drug. People who use the life-saving injection are outraged at its cost, which has increased 500% since 2009. The company, Mylan, sells a two-pack of EpiPens for around $600. The new generic version will cost about half that. And joining us now to talk more about this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And remind us of the backstory here and how all of this anger against Mylan got started.
Well, Mylan acquired the EpiPen back in 2007. This is a severe allergy treatment. It's not a new thing, actually. It's decades old. At that time, pharmacies were paying about $100 for a two-pen set, and as you said, up 500%, over $600. Now, when this initially hit, Mylan blamed high deductible insurance plans. They said, that's the problem here. Here's a coupon. We'll make it work. But it really started to gather a lot of steam, catching the attention of lawmakers. And there was also a petition online to stop the EpiPen price gouging. Got about 50,000 signatures, so the story would not die.
And at the center of the story was Mylan's CEO, Heather Bresch, who, by the way, is the daughter of Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. She's taking a lot of heat because, for one thing, her salary has gone up significantly as the price of the EpiPen has increased.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Sales of EpiPens make up about $1 billion in revenue a year. So you could see how a pharmaceutical company would say, hey, let's start raising the price from $100 higher because it just keeps making money for them. Bresch's compensation up, get this, over 670%. So sales, so we had the price up 500%, her money, her comp up 670% between 2007 and 2015. I think that a lot of people are just kind of waiting to see. She could get hauled before a congressional subcommittee and questioned, and we know that's a terrible place for a CEO to be, and we don't know whether this PR storm is going to die down anytime soon.
And meanwhile, the generic drug drug that Mylan says now that it's going to be introducing is still quite expensive.
Yeah, $300. So, I mean, honestly, you know, you went from $100, $300. That's still triple the price it was in 2007. You know, I don't know. There's got to be some sweet spot where the company can make money on something that it acquired, spent a bunch of money acquiring. But there's also a public health part of this, which is how many people are using the drug and who's affected by this. You may remember that we had a similar conversation about certain cancer treatments that had ballooned,
right,
and they were old treatments. So there's a lot of people using this. I think that there's going to be some action on this, especially because of how many people are involved.
And if the company is going to offer a generic version of the EpiPen, does that open the market up to competitors to put out a similar product?
You know, in this, it might have in different cases. In this particular one, Mylan doesn't actually face some immediate generic threat. There are other companies that are looking for opportunities, but not so much yet. We had a generic version from another drug company rejected by the FDA earlier, but maybe now there's going to be a little more action, other people coming in. We know that the more competition there is, the more generic opportunities there are for people who have these health conditions, the better it is for consumers.
And meanwhile, just an outrageous story, and people can read more about it at our website, hereandnow.org. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money, thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
New rules out today clear the way for commercial drone use in the United States. The Federal Aviation Administration says drones can't fly higher than 400 feet, they can't go faster than 100 miles an hour, and they can't carry a combined load that's more than 55 pounds. You have to be at least 16 years old to fly a commercial drone, and you have to pass a test and get a license. More than 3,300 people have already signed up to take that test, which is available starting today. I spoke with FAA Administrator Michael Huerta about the agency's plans for commercial drones back in March, and I asked him, of all the issues the FAA has to worry about, how important are drones?
It's incredibly important. This is the fastest growing segment in aviation, and it is also something that's bringing a whole host of new users into our aviation system. These are not the traditional pilots or air traffic controllers that we deal with. These are hobbyists, these are photographers, real estate brokers, and so it's a big challenge to integrate and work with this community to make sure that we're all operating safely.
Did it surprise you that drones became so popular among the American public?
This is something that we have been looking at for a while, but I think that all of us have been surprised at how they've really captured the public imagination. You know, when you think about it, this is a technology that is evolving so quickly, and even from where we sit today, we can't fully imagine all the possible uses that unmanned aircraft will be put to in the future. It's you know, an incredibly innovative technology, but it raises very serious questions of how do we incorporate them into what is increasingly a crowded sky and make sure that we're doing it in a safe manner.
Well, looking back, do you wish that the FAA had started requiring people to register their drones before this year? Because they've been around for years now.
They have been around for a while, but I think that one of the things that we've been very focused on is trying a whole lot of different things to try to accommodate and respond to the technology. The thing that really got our attention was the projected sales that were expected before we went into the holiday season. And we thought that this represented two things. The first was it represented a big challenge of how do we educate all of these people about what the rules of the air are. But the second thing was, hey, this is a great opportunity to reach out to this whole new segment. And we were able in a matter of a couple of months to put together a registration protocol and program. And as of today, we have over 385,000 people registered with their unmanned aircraft.
What are the rules of the air at this point?
Well, the key thing when you're operating in the air is a principle called sense and avoid or detect and avoid. And so, you know, essentially what we want these operators to understand is where are airports and how to avoid them, how they can ensure that they're not coming into conflict with other aircraft that are out there. And we're advising them to stay out of controlled airspace, stay below altitudes where they could come into conflict with commercial or general aviation aircraft.
What would happen if a drone were to hit an aircraft? Because if you think about it, an airplane, I mean, especially if it's a big commercial airplane, is a huge, you know, thing compared to this tiny little drone that probably weighs a couple of pounds. Would the airplane be harmed by being hit by a drone?
Well, the first thing is there are many, many different kinds of drones. You're right that some of those are under a half pound, and they would likely be blown out of the way by a large commercial aircraft that's coming in the vicinity. But there are unmanned aircraft that are very high performance. Some are as large with the wingspan of a 737. And they could bump into another aircraft. They could get sucked into an engine. And those are the things that we don't want to have happen.
And when you receive reports of 100 a month of aircraft pilots who say they're spotting drones flying near them, it sounds like something's going wrong here.
Well, a big part of that is education. We're doing three things to try to address that. The first is educating people of where the airports are in the first place. We've developed a smartphone app that you're able to turn on. It's called Before You Fly. You can download it from the Apple App Store. And you turn on your phone and it tells you, based on right where you're standing, are there any flight restrictions in place? The second thing is, you know, unfortunately, there will always be some small number of people that will be interested in perhaps causing a problem or doing something that is not safe flying. And so that's where our enforcement responsibilities come in.
And who does that enforcement?
We do that cooperatively with local law enforcement. We have the ability to issue civil penalties on our own. There are criminal penalties associated with interfering with commercial aviation.
Is there a penalty right now for not registering your drone?
There are penalties in place if you don't register, because there is a requirement to register. But we're very focused on educating people of the requirement at this point.
Aside from the legality, what do you say to the criticism that these rules are just overly complicated in terms of where you can fly, how high, having the rules change based on size, that pretty soon people may need to take lessons and maybe get a license?
I don't think that they're overly complicated. For a small recreational users, it's basically a handful of things that we're asking you to do. Stay away from an airport, stay below 400 feet, maintain line of sight, and don't do anything stupid. Now, if you want to do high-performance commercial activities, yes, it's a little more complicated, but we have many tracks that we're operating on right now. We have a rulemaking that's underway that we want to complete this spring that will lay out for a very large class of users what the regulatory requirements and framework are for you to operate. And what they're going to find is it's nowhere near as complicated as doing it with regular aircraft.
Do you think that somebody should need a license, though, for any size of drone at this point?
For commercial activities, I think it is important that they have a commercial certificate of some sort. Now, we are not saying that that is the same thing as a pilot's license, because you don't need to know the principles of how to fly an airplane. That's not what you're flying. But you do need to understand how you interact with other aircraft and what the rules of the air are. And so what we're trying to do is come up with what are the actual requirements that somebody has to have in order to, you know, operate unmanned aircraft for commercial purposes.
So as we've been talking, what I hear from you is that your main concern is safety.
Mm-hmm.
What about privacy? Does that come into what you think about when it comes to regulating drones? Because at this point, I guess somebody could probably, you know, launch a drone in their backyard, go fly over to the neighbor's house and put it right outside the window.
Yeah, the FAA's responsibility is safety. We don't regulate anything that flies in our airspace for its use. We regulate it only for its safety.
Does anyone at this point?
But the question you're raising about privacy is an important question for us as a government, as a society. And that is something that our partners in government are actively looking at. President Obama asked the U.S. Department of Commerce through the National Telecommunications and Information Agency to lead an effort to really assess this question of, do we have the appropriate controls in place? Is the current legal framework sufficient to ensure that a citizen's right to privacy is being adequately protected? And we're actively participating as part of that.
Administrator Huerta, if somebody came out and said, we should just ban all drones, that nobody needs a drone, why do we allow drones? What would you say to that person?
If we had that point of view of just banning evolution of new technology, I think that we as a society would be nowhere near where we are today. You know, think about it. Aviation is over 100 years old. Today, it represents 5% of our gross domestic product, and it employs 12 million Americans. It is our largest export industry, and it is really the foundation for lots of technology all across our economy. So what we have is a history of seeing something new and innovative being developed, and we collectively, as an industry, working collaboratively, government and the private sector, we've been able to come up with regulatory standards, all designed to ensure safety, but at the same time to leverage the benefits of technology. And I don't see this one as any different from that.
Do you own a drone?
I do not own a drone. I have registered, though, so I'm one of those that's below one in terms of ownership. I'm still shopping around. I haven't quite found the exact fit of what I would like to see and my budget. But when I get one, it'll be used recreationally for photography. I love taking pictures.
That's FAA Administrator Michael Huerta. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we spoke back in March. Huerta said today there could be as many as 600,000 commercial drones in use within the year. We will post the new rules that are out today from the FAA at hereandnow.org.
So North Korea says it can now strike the U.S. mainland with a nuclear weapon. Chairman Kim Jong-un made that claim after North Korea successfully launched a ballistic missile from a submarine for the first time last week. South Korean officials said the missile was launched toward Japan and traveled about 310 miles, about half the actual distance between the two countries, although Japanese officials said the missile did reach its air defense identification zone, which is raising the question, should there be more sanctions against North Korea? Our security expert says, well, maybe not. Existing sanctions haven't done much to stop the country's nuclear weapons program. Jim Walsh is with MIT Security Studies Program. He joins us in the studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Robin.
And start with that claim made by Kim Jong-un. Does North Korea have the ability to hit the U.S. mainland with a nuclear weapon?
The answer is a flat no, and they wouldn't have that capability for quite some time. But it's important to remember that we have U.S. forces in South Korea, we have U.S. forces in Japan, and it's conceivable that they could build a simple device and put it in a plane. So we've already sort of crossed that theoretical threshold. There are American forces who are at risk if they decided to do that. I don't think they're going to do it, but that is a theoretical possibility.
And that goes to the claim that they can hit Americans. But there are, you know, Japanese and South Koreans at risk already. So are you alarmed by this latest test?
Well, I think it's another in a slow progression where they're building their capability. I always say that they're in the muddy middle in the nuclear world. They've gotten that capability, but they haven't gotten quite to the point where they have a militarily reliable, secure second strike, which is sort of the definition of a modern nuclear weapon state. So there's still time to slow down this program, hopefully to freeze it and roll it back. But time grows shorter every day.
Yeah, and also you've pointed out they don't have submarines large and advanced enough to travel the long distance, across the Pacific.
Right.
But we have this latest test. Now, there was a fourth nuclear test in January. There have been other ballistic missile tests, all in defiance of UN resolutions, and they prompted the existing sanctions. You and your colleague, John Park at Harvard, did the research and found that North Korea's state trading companies, these are the STCs, are already getting around the sanctions that are imposed?
Exactly. You've put your finger right on it. We were trying to answer this puzzle. How is it that we keep putting on sanctions and they keep on testing and even improving their capabilities? And what we did is we studied North Korea, Inc., this system of trading companies. And what we found is they have innovated in the face of sanctions. You know, we keep on passing sanctions, same verse, a little louder, but they've actually use countermeasures. They've buried themselves, burrowed into China. And what they do is they hire private Chinese middlemen, private brokers who go and represent them, do the procurement. It looks like the company's selling it to a Chinese firm, not a North Korean firm. And that's how they're able to get around the sanctions that are in place.
So, be clear. I was kind of hinting at what you're saying. Are you saying the sanctions don't work? More sanctions won't work? What are you saying?
I'm saying we have to do it differently and we have to respond to their innovations. I mean, the irony here, one of the shocking findings in our study counterintuitively, is that in some ways sanctions actually helped their procurement, improved it, because what would happen is we'd impose costs on the North Koreans. They'd turn around and monetize that cost and simply paid higher commission fees to their Chinese partners, and the higher commission fees drew bigger, more capable fish. So how do we get at that? First, we just disrupt North Korea, North Korean Inc. directly. Secondly, we have to find a way to work with China. 90% of all the trade with North Korea comes from China, and we're going to have to work with the Chinese. And we say, let's encourage them to use their domestic laws, their anti-counterfeiting, their anti-corruption, those sorts of laws.
Because they're trying to fight these things anyway.
Yes, exactly. Things they're already committed to, mm-hmm. already a national priority for the Chinese government. But turn the focus of some of those to the private Chinese brokers that are helping the North Koreans import WMD-related technology.
Yeah, to use the laws they already have. And you say that will what? That will not put China in the position of looking like it's directly responding to the U.S. about North Korea.
Yes, it doesn't look like they're – it won't make them look like they're doing our bidding. And remember, the Chinese are sort of caught in a pickle here. They don't want North Korea to have nuclear weapons, but they're afraid if they squeeze them too hard, they'll end up with a failed nuclear weapons state on their doorstep. So the question is, how do you thread that needle, squeeze them so that they don't get nuclear, you know, advance their nuclear and missile programs, but not while at the same time not doing things that would cause the sudden collapse of the country. So the way to get China on board with that, we think, is to have common purpose and really target these Chinese private middlemen who are helping the North Koreans do their business.
Just a few seconds left here. We're in an election year. How much of a priority should North Korea be for the next president of the United States?
Well, I think it's going to be a continuing challenge. You know, I feel good about the Iran nuclear situation. I think the agreement pretty much battened that down as far as a nuclear threat. So the big one out there, the two big ones are North Korea, and they're going to continue to be provocative, and they've got this young leader, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen next. And then I continue to worry about India and Pakistan, who both possess nuclear weapons. We don't want to see a conflict between those two countries. So those are the two big nuclear priorities, if you ask me.
And they're big, and we are asking you, and we are respecting your response. Jim Walsh, here now, security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. There's a link to the research that he and his colleague did at hereandnow.org. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. I don't think I've heard India and Pakistan come up once in this campaign season, but maybe a good question for the debates coming up.
Yeah, if we have them.
It's Here Now.